In this two-part mini-series, we explore intergenerational trauma and its impacts on Indigenous individuals and communities. In part one, we chat with Dr. Cynthia Wesley Eskema, who has written several academic articles focused on the history of intergenerational trauma that Indigenous peoples continue to experience in their day-to-day lives. This subject matter is sensitive and could trigger all sorts of reactions instantly or later on. Please reach out for help if needed. Dr. Cynthia Wesley Eskema, thank you for joining us. You've been researching and raising awareness, doing public education about intergenerational trauma for 25, 30 years. Could we start by defining what intergenerational trauma is?
Well, from my perspective, it's the passing on of traumas that have occurred over generations going back to contact on this continent, people that were traumatized by the epidemics that occurred when contact first occurred, and the multiple deaths that occurred through the Indian Wars, through the relocation process, through the Indian residential schools, and into contemporary traumas like the missing and murdered Indigenous women and the child welfare system, which passes on unresolved grief and trauma to the next generations, not only by storytelling, but by behaviors and by the way people are living their lives and, you know, sort of unconsciously doing things that display their hurt and pass it on to their young children. And of course, we also talk sometimes about blood memory, that it's also a genetic thing, and epigenetics plays a role as well in how traumas that occurred maybe even 100 years before can still be resonating into the present.
I think you're raising a good point, obviously, but that because usually we point the finger at residential schools when we talk about intergenerational trauma, and rightly so. But there have been historical traumas one after the other, after the other, after the other, over centuries, without time to grieve between those bad, quote unquote, bad things. So much so that we're talking about PTSD, right?
And we talk about complex post-traumatic stress disorder, which is basically saying that everyone in a community or a family will be affected, but they will be affected differently. You know, they're not all going to be the same. So on a continuum, you know, when you look at a continuum of, let's just take a family, and the father, you know, was in the war and came back, and he has post-traumatic stress disorder individually. His behavior is going to collectively affect the entire family. So the complex, you know, it's complex. It means that one son may act out in one way and another son may act out in another way, be the best at everything. The other son may become an alcoholic. Like, there's just different ways that everybody's affected. So when you look at a community or the mm-hmm. First Nation communities across Canada, when we look at complex post-traumatic stress, that's what we're saying. Is we're saying everybody is affected, even if they didn't go to residential school themselves or have a parent that went, because the behaviors around them are adversely affecting their ability to see themselves in a positive way. But we were also talking about, you know, the distance between and the ability to actually monitor, you know, hurts. And, you know, we were talking at one point about, the length of time that has passed. And I know in my own research, when I started to do that at the University of Toronto, they said I should look at the residential school experience. And I thought, no, I think it's deeper than that. So I decided in my master's work to look at a comparative analysis of the aftermath of the bubonic plagues in Europe and the aftermath of the epidemics on this continent. And that's where I realized, you know, the epidemics hit on average every 7 to 14 years, which gave people very little time to sort of retune and to deal with the hurts and the death and the destruction that they were experiencing. Whereas in Europe, where the bubonic plagues were, they hit on average every 40 years. So that gave people lots of time to reconstitute their cultures and their populations mm-hmm. and their economics. So there's a real difference in terms of how things play themselves out. But we're all human beings, and human beings all react the same way to different kinds of hurt. So, you know, the addictions happened in Europe, you know, the Reformation happened, you know, moving away from the church because the church was not providing the kinds of supports and understandings that people felt it should. And on this continent, a lot of people moved away from traditional healers because they weren't able to deal with the kinds of epidemics that were coming. They didn't know how to deal with influenza. They didn't know how to deal with smallpox, but the missionaries did. So you see in both instances, lots of shifting as people searched, sometimes without real, you know, help from place to place to try to figure out what to do. And here, you know, we're now coming to the understanding that we can reach out, and that we also have more wisdom than we thought actually existing in our communities from forever. I mean, our traditional healers are very adept at this once we've turned back to them and given them the opportunity to help us.
It affects people individually, and it affects whole communities. It must be very difficult for someone to actually know where to reach out for help, because everyone's affected, right?
Yeah, and I think that for a long time, people didn't really know that they needed to reach out. You know, they just lived with it, because you have to remember, in the schools, children were denied the right to question. Couldn't say, I feel sad, or I feel sorry, or I feel sick, because they were punished for any kind of an expression that wasn't, I guess, positive in the eyes of the nuns and the various instructors who were supposedly looking after them. So they learned to be very helpless in the face of their own pain, and they learned to bury it quite deep. So there was no real sense of a need to actually look for assistance. And so out of that came a lot of the addictions. So people were self-medicating themselves to try to deal with what was inside that they couldn't put outside of themselves, until we had the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and we had conversations with people that actually said, you know, not what's wrong with you, but what happened to you, and started to understand that there was this, you know, sort of inner deep well of pain that people were trying to resolve and didn't really know how to do that. And of course, it was, you know, don't forget, we're just coming out of a long era of stigma associated with mental health and the ability to go and even see a counselor, which was felt to be a weakness. You know, if you couldn't deal with it yourself, there was something, you know, more wrong with you know, than the issues that you were fighting.
You mentioned helplessness or powerlessness a few times. Like, that's what my life is, and it can't be different, and that's how things are for us. The world is hostile to us. Isn't hopelessness the biggest obstacle to healing?
Yeah, the question of powerlessness or hopelessness in a community, I think, is also really important. And again, it's directly related to the idea that the community itself and the people in it have no real power or authority to make decisions. Or they can't say, this needs to be funded, and actually have it happen. The powerlessness that exists in adults gets easily transmitted to the young people. You know, they feel it quite strongly. I mean, young people are watching us all the time, and they know when we're unhappy, or when we're happy, or when we're scared. And when they, you know, if my mother is scared, then I'm scared, because she's the person who's going to protect me and ensure that I'm okay. So we have to, you know, we have to help the young people, yes, it's true, but we also have to help the parents. We have to help the other people in the community who are struggling with the same kinds of issues. Everybody's affected, and it may not look the same in every single individual. Some individuals may be suffering and using addictions, whether it's a sex addiction or food addiction or a drug addiction or an alcohol addiction. They're using something to help to mitigate that. Other people may be the busiest people in the community. They're running hither and yon and fixing this and fixing that. It's still an addiction, and it helps them deal with their pain, but it's not necessarily healthy. And there are other people in the community who just are suffering from depression and moving, you know, dangerously close to suicide, because they don't feel like they have any options whatsoever other than dying and getting away.
So there's the trauma from the past that Indigenous individuals have to deal with. But then when you live in a, especially in a remote area where employment or education opportunities are not there, or the living conditions are not to par with the rest of Canadian society, I mean, there's the day-to-day challenges on top of the rest. I mean, it's got to be hard for Indigenous people to deal with all of this
yes.
at once.
It's very difficult for Indigenous communities to deal with the really kind of imposed poverty and inability to get access to the kinds of services that they need. The other, you know, the other side of that is the Indigenous community that has done well, and but maybe they have the education, or they have a good job, or they have a home, you know, they have a home to live in, and or they're raising children in a good way, are also still a part of that conversation, because many of the community members who have who have stepped away from the community and gotten those benefits very rarely leaves the community and are, you know, continue to work very closely with those issues and those concerns. So it, you know, the question of that trauma doesn't go away. It's still very present in our lives, even when we have a doctorate, and even when we, you know, we live far, you know, we don't live in a community. You know, I happen to live in a community who has just recently experienced some suicides, and even though I don't, I'm not necessarily right there because I'm in Aurelia right now. We're all dramatically affected by that. And this is not a community that's particularly poor. It's not a remote community in the same sense. It's remote in the sense it's on an island, and it's a challenge to get on and off the island, especially now. But it's not the same as living in a remote community that to get to a doctor, you have to medevac out and stay out for right. a significant amount of time away from your family and your community, and then be medevac back in again. But the question, I guess, for a lot of those communities who surprisingly have people in them that are doing really quite well. You know, it's not like everybody in the community, because they're in a remote area, is not doing well. They are. And they have their own ways of dealing with their isolation and with their inability to, you know, have proper right. homes built. They actually find ways to ensure that their community mental health is dealt with. And whether it's feasts or whether it's bringing together people for ceremony or for community events of some kind, they actually manage quite well.
Yeah, and it's another thing also, if you're an Indigenous person coming to live in a big city and then you encounter racism of all kinds, then something else hits I guess.
That's the concern with intergenerational effect. Because if you have a healthy beginning, and you have a strong mm-hmm. family roots and your community is doing well, and you move from that community into an urban center, you have what we call resiliency. You know, you have a bank account of mental health that helps to buffer those issues, right? You don't feel like every time you turn around, somebody's out to yeah. get you. But for those people who are living in communities that are struggling, and many of them are, with addictions or with poverty, it is an additional load or burden to come into an urban center and not feel comfortable there or not feel welcomed. Again, location has a lot to do with the outcomes. My parents both went to residential school, both had traumatic experiences there, both, you know, struggled with addiction and violence. But because I was raised in Toronto, a lot of the residential school survivors went into the larger cities to be able to work. So because I was raised in Toronto, I had a different kind of a life experience, and the things around me were different. Mm-hmm. The people around me were different. I mean, there were lots. I mean, I was raised in Toronto in the 60s and 70s. You know, we had the annual caravan where, you know, all of the cultures across yeah. the city were represented and celebrated. So there was a lot of influences yeah. on me and other people in my age group that gave us the possibility of change. You know, we were handed tools that made it different. It's not that we didn't suffer, because we did. I mean, I dropped out of school at 16 and, you know, I had to go to work, and, you know, there was different ways and things that occurred in my life, but I had a better chance than a community where residential school survivors are coming back into remote communities where there's no social services or, you know, movie theaters or, you know, external sort of distractions.
You mentioned suicide. What is it that we don't understand about this crisis?
Well, one of the things that we don't understand or actually we just don't feel comfortable yeah. addressing in a lot of communities, including the non-Indigenous community, is sexual abuse. Okay. And how demoralizing and dehumanizing it actually is. It, you know, it breaks trust, it breaks boundaries, it breaks, you know, young minds. And we've seen a lot of people going to jail over the last while, or being, you know, being taken to court, especially very famous yeah. people, because of the Me Too situation. And it does exist in Indigenous community now. It's much lower under the radar, but it's happening. And the question of sexual abuse is a really serious one that the kids, you know, I mean, the research has told me that most people, and this is not Indigenous people, anybody, most people do not even disclose sexual abuse until they're over 30 years of age. So you have these young kids having this experience and carrying that and thinking that they're the only one, or that there's something sadly wrong with them, or they caused the problem themselves. It's a very serious conversation. How do we solve this particular piece? How do we, you know, get to this and have people have the conversation so that we can help kids be safe? And it doesn't matter whether they're in their own homes or whether in foster care or adoptive care, they're vulnerable. And we know that all the way back to Freud and, you know, and since, that, you know, you look at the statistics and you look at the research, and it's a problem that kids seemingly have to deal with by themselves. I mean, I didn't have that conversation with my mother until I was over 40. Wow. So I know, you know, how it works. I was there. And I know that a lot of young people are in those places where they don't get an opportunity to be listened to, or they're disbelieved. Look at the residential school experience. They were silenced by the government and by the people in those schools, and their parents quite often. You know, I mean, Thompson Highway, who's very famous and wrote Kiss of the Fur Queen about his experience, said they would never tell their parents about what was going on in the school, because their parents were very devout Catholics, and they would be punished if they were to ever speak against the people in those schools who were their teachers and their guardians. So that's a common experience for a lot of young people who have gone through residential school experiences out of their parents' experience, is that it was brought back to the communities, and it has proliferated because it's a silent scourge. People are unwilling or reluctant to speak about it in their households, and they carry it forward. And I know from personal experience, and I actually spoke to a counselor, a psychologist from remote communities, who's done that work for now 40 years. And I asked her, how many people that you deal with of all ages have had the experience of sexual abuse? And she said 100%. So when you think about suicide, and you think about, you know, some of the dysfunctions, and you think about the intergenerational effect and the intergenerational trauma that we're trying to heal, if it keeps happening and it keeps getting handed down and it stays in the dark, how are we ever going to stop it?
I'm thinking about the religious discourse, where what's happening to you is your own damn fault. You must have done something for God to be mad at you and punish you. And it still lingers.
People quite across the country quite often say to me, because I do a lot of public education, you know, what's wrong with these people? You know, why can't they just get on with it? Or why can't they just forget that, you know, that these things happen and move forward? And it's like, well, I think they would very much like to do that. But like any person that's gone and sought out therapeutic help, they need that additional support until they get to that place. And those very bad habits that have been developed in their population because of things like the residential school, sexual violence, domestic violence, some of the, you know, the language loss, those things have to be discussed by the entire country and supported, and many times financially. So that's, you know, it's a big conversation, and it's a big question that needs to be answered.
I was wondering if you had some words of wisdom or suggestions in terms of public policies or services.
You know, a lot of the conversation revolves around money. But it doesn't necessarily have to be that. I mean, there's this restoration of jurisdiction and authority to Indigenous people, so they have the ability to make decisions for themselves. Mm-hmm. The whole question of how child welfare is administrated is a really important question, because, you know, social workers feel they have the right to step into communities and take children without really what we would call just cause. There's a powerlessness there in those communities that needs to be addressed. Sometimes it's about recognition of those rights as opposed to funding them. You know, sometimes it's just about saying, you know, we recognize. So the Supreme Court of Canada has done a good job of saying, yes, we recognize it's important. The restoration of lands, the sharing of resources out of the land-based resources that Canada survives on, like, where, you know, that's how Canada generates a lot of its wealth. And giving a share of those resources to indigenous communities that actually live on those lands where those resources are being taken will make a difference. Because you just look across the country, in places where indigenous communities have had access to wealth, that they have been able to build more wealth. And, you know, it's like that whole conversation, it takes money to make money.
Yeah.
And in places where that's happened, communities have become very self-sufficient and have created economy and employment and health and mental wellness in their communities. So it's clear that it can be done. The question is, how committed are we as a country to making that happen? We were talking the other day about, young kids coming into Canada from other countries that are experiencing trauma. There's war and there's, lots of things going on in the country. We know if we don't address the needs of those children, that we'll be having the same kinds of conversations about their lives 10, 15, 20 years from now, because we have to resolve what has gone wrong so that we can set people on a path towards what's right and good for them.
Yeah, so by welcoming all of these kids from other countries, we inherit some of their trauma and we need to deal with that.
Yeah, I mean, you can see the impact just by looking around you, but you can see the impact on the Indigenous community and on the Black community. You know, there's a lot of kids in care who are coming out and joining gangs and getting themselves thrown back into jail because they don't have the skills, social or otherwise, to live in the world. And because we have a punitive system of justice, we don't do restorative justice like they did in Indigenous communities around the world. So we had kids who go to jail for sometimes minor infractions. Maybe they breached their rules of, you know, of conduct. They go back in and then they come out and they are marked for life. And then those kids they don't feel good about themselves. They're marked, so a lot of people won't hire them into jobs because they feel they're not trusted. And we have a whole population then that resorts to other ways of making money that are dangerous and actually bring other people into bad places because they get addicted to the drugs that they may be selling. So, you know, we're not thinking, I don't see about how we might do a better job and get these kids, all kids. When I was working with the Canadian Roots Exchange, when we started the Canadian Roots Exchange in 2008, the goal was to have half and half, half Indigenous, half non-Indigenous kids come together to go out on the land, to talk to elders and talk to people with wisdom about life and, you know, give them the privilege of seeing what it was like to live differently. And a lot of those kids have gone on to do some amazing stuff. Give them the opportunity. I mean, that's what Call to Action 66 said, that Canada should support financially and otherwise the youth organizations across the country so that kids have a way of helping each other to resolve the hurt that they've experienced so that they can move forward in a good way.
Yeah, I've talked to a director of one of the friendship centers here in Quebec, and she was saying how important it is to have a culturally safe environment for Indigenous individuals to come in and, you know, start healing.
But they don't get the resources that they actually require. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of the problem, is that there have been some very good programs that have been established to help not only young people, but adults deal with some of the intergenerational trauma that they've experienced or the contemporary trauma that they're presently experiencing. And they don't get funded. You know, they run for a year or they're like a pilot and they run for a year or so. And then nobody wants to fund it again, or the government changes in the province or in the federal, and then that program is no longer seen as necessary or viable. So that's got to change. I mean, I think it's one of the things that are probably the most important thing we can do is when programs are working and they're doing a great job, is that we somehow need to lock in, you know, the funding board for a significant amount of time, whether it's 5 or 10 years. They need to be supported because they're doing the work that needs to get done that not everybody can do. So there, when you talk about resources, that's one of the areas I think that we have to talk about is how do you get the dollars that get allocated from the federal provincial governments to the ground?
Working on this topic for 25, 30 years, is there a better understanding now of what intergenerational trauma is compared to 25, 30 years ago?
Well, I think there's a better public understanding of it. I think that we've always I mean, if you're a Christian, you're raised in a Christian faith, you know, you've heard of the sins of the father and the understanding that things get passed on in populations and families. I mean, there's that idea that, you know, whatever happened back then is going to reoccur if we don't actually deal with it. So I think people understood at some level that there was this thing called intergenerational trauma or blood memory or whatever you wanted to call it. But now I think, the public is uptaking the idea of addressing trauma in a very big way. So now wherever I go, I hear conversations about being trauma informed. And, you know, of course, that whole question around epigenetics coming forward, how things get stimulated in a child's brain from childhood on, whether it's fear or whether it's actually support and education and stimulation to learning. So there's lots of conversations that are going on now. And there's sort of the rejoining of the head to the body, because, you know, there was a separation at one point where dealt with the head and what was going on there intellectually and mentally. And then the body was a whole other kind of conversation that was dealt with by another kind of a doctor. But now we're understanding that everything is actually associated to everything else. So if you have a mental health issue, it affects how your stomach works and your digestion, and it affects the inflammation in your system, and it affects a whole lot of things. So people are finally coming around to the idea that the question of holism and taking a holistic approach to health is important, and that's something that Indigenous peoples have known all along. And certainly a lot of traditional cultures, you know, whether it's China or Chinese or Japanese or a lot of the other older places where people have practiced holistic medicine, they know that you have to treat the whole body.
What do you want to leave us with in terms of last comments or about intergenerational trauma?
It doesn't matter what color you are. You know, I've said to you, quite often, just sort of in a teasing way, I'll say to people, you know, 97% of the population has experienced some form of trauma, and the other 3% are lying. Because truly, most people have had some kind of an experience with trauma in their contemporary lives, and their parents, depending on where they've come from, whether they're Indigenous from a remote community, right, or they've come from Syria, or they've come from Iran, or they've come from another place, have experienced something there as well. And maybe it's the parent that did it or the grandparent, but it's still affecting the family unit. When we have the conversation with each other about intergenerational trauma and the effects it has on our lives, I would like people to relearn, how to be compassionate. Rather than judging and thinking that person is either lying or didn't happen, is to just listen with compassion and empathy and help that person feel supported and believed. Because we can't stop things if we're not willing to talk about it, if we're not willing to bring it out of the darkness and into the light. So that, I mean, I think that's probably the most important thing that we can do. Is learn to stand together and help each other stop the things that are happening in our communities and in our neighborhoods and in our kids' lives, and help each other to resolve the hurts that have already happened so that we can move on into a better life for ourselves.
Yeah, more compassion. I think we can all use that overall.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This podcast is a production of the Canada School of Public Service. To learn more about the school's offerings in its Indigenous Learning Series, please visit our website at csps-efpc.gc.ca. This is Annie Leblanc, and on behalf of the school, thank you for listening.